The American History Podcast, Season 1, Episode 8, The Protestant Reformation and the Puritans.
Welcome to the American History Podcast. Hosted by Sean Worswick.
Hello and welcome to the American History Podcast. First, before we begin, I'd just like to invite you to follow our new Twitter account dedicated to the show. Give us a follow at American HisCast on Twitter. You can also check out the Facebook group. Also, please check out the show's website, theamericanhistorypodcast.com. I have a page dedicated to sources that I've used to create each episode, so you can read some of the books that I've read to create these episodes. Of course, the list is not exhaustive. I've just given you a few of the books that I think you'll find helpful. If you want more information, you can go there. If you need more than what I'm giving you there, just shoot me an email. Now a bit of disclosure. This episode was originally recorded and released in January 2018. I had recently moved schools and life was a bit chaotic, so I don't think I did the best job that I could have done on this one. It is now 2020, and in celebration of our third anniversary, I'm rewriting this episode and re-recording it. So this is not the original episode, and it will be significantly longer than that one. In that one, I tried just to focus exclusively on the part of the Reformation that applied to American history. I'm changing that here, and we're going to spend more time simply discussing the Reformation. So this is why this episode is significantly longer than the original one. Okay, so when we talk about the Reformation, or at least when I taught AP European History, we started off with the causes. In general, there were four major causes. The first was the crises of the 14th and 15th centuries, which ended up damaging the prestige of the clergy and the church. If you aren't familiar with these crises, they were the Babylonian captivity of the 14th century, the Western Schism, sometimes referred to as the Great Schism, which lasted from 1377 to 1417. This was a period in which two men claimed to be pope simultaneously. You also had the conciliar movement to reform the church and give a church council more power than the pope. This was rejected, surprisingly, by several popes in the 15th and 16th centuries. Now, a second major problem was the sheer amount of corruption in the church. This can be viewed as having seven different aspects. First, you had simony, or the sale of church offices. In 1487, for example, the pope sold 24 offices. The problem wasn't just selling the offices, but the fact that they were sold to unqualified men. These men became bishops or cardinals, taking away opportunity for those who were far more qualified and deserving of the positions. Another aspect of corruption was pluralism, or holding more than one office at a time. This meant that things which needed to get done often didn't. The third major cause was the rise of a group of critics. These critics included men such as John Wycliffe in England. Living from 1329 to 1384, he stated the sole authority in religion was the Bible. In this, he foreshadowed Martin Luther, who also argued that the Bible was the sole source of religious authority. Furthermore, he stressed the need for personal communion with God and less of a focus on the sacraments. He translated the Bible into English and encouraged that it should be translated into other vernacular languages. His followers, known as the Lollards, continued his ideas well into the 16th century. Some of the things they advocated were predestination while attacking the veneration of saints, the sacraments, monasticism, and even the very existence of the papacy. It should be no wonder that, in 1415, the church retroactively excommunicated him as a forerunner of the Protestant Reformation. Now, a fourth factor was the Renaissance, and especially the rise of Christian humanism. The Christian humanists of the Northern Renaissance criticized the church and questioned the validity of the Latin Vulgate Bible. The rise of textual criticism and new translations of the Bible, which were spread far and wide thanks to the existence of the printing press, all helped to undermine the authority of the church. The Italian Renaissance was, at times, marked by a de-emphasis on religion while emphasizing secularism and individualism amongst the church leadership. This, understandably, drew significant criticism of those who opposed the moral decline in the church. And so that brings us to Martin Luther. He was a reform-minded Augustinian monk who taught at the University of Wittenberg in Saxony. All might have been well had it not been for a man named Johann Tetzel. Tetzel was authorized by Pope Leo X to sell indulgences. These were payments that would be reduced, or that would reduce a person's punishment in purgatory, or perhaps the pain of a loved one who had already died. Sadly, one of the men who tends to get a lot of blame for the start of the Reformation is Tetzel. He was at one point the Inquisitor of Poland and Saxony, and eventually the Grand Commissioner for Indulgences in Germany. Like I said a moment ago, he was authorized to sell indulgences. He is supposed to have said, quote, "As soon as a coin in the coffer rings, the soul from purgatory springs," end quote. The source of all this was the fact that the Pope was looking for additional revenues to pay for the construction of Michelangelo's dome atop St. Peter's Basilica in Rome. Tetzel's selling of indulgences, a practice which, by the way, had been in operation long before he came around, became egregious. Thus, on October 31st, 1517, we get the 95 Theses. Luther criticized the selling of indulgences, but went further than others before him by questioning the scriptural authority of the Pope to grant these indulgences. Now, whether Luther actually nailed his 95 Theses to the Wittenberg church door, or he sent them to his resident bishop instead, is a matter of historical dispute. What we do know is that they spread far and wide, thanks to the 16th century version of the internet, an invention known as the printing press. The heart of this was the fact that Luther represented a challenge to church authority. Initially, the Pope viewed the issue as an insignificant disagreement between Augustinian and Dominican monks. Theological debates amongst the clergy were not unprecedented. However, by 1518, the Pope appears to have changed his mind and ordered Luther to stop his crusade. Luther refused. He was able to do this because he was protected by Elector Frederick III, aka the Wise, of Saxony. Now, at this point, Luther did not want to create a new church, but to reform the Catholic Church. I should mention that reform movements were nothing new to the church and had come along every few centuries during the Middle Ages. However, this one proved to be different. In 1519, a debate was held at Leipzig between Luther and Johann Eck, one of the great Catholic theologians of the day. Luther denied the infallibility of the Pope and the infallibility of a general council. He claimed that the church erred when it executed John Huss for heresy, and by the end of the debate, he realized he had passed the point of no return. The next year, he published his ideas on church reform in three separate works, and his thoughts can be summarized by seven major points. First, he believed salvation could be achieved through faith alone. Second, he said the sole source of authority was the Bible. Third, only two sacraments, baptism and communion, were valid. Fourth, the church consisted of a, quote, "priesthood of all believers," end quote, not a hierarchical structure. Fifth, he criticized the sale of indulgences and simony. Sixth, he encouraged German princes to reform the church in their states. Seventh, he rejected the Catholic monastic tenets of poverty, chastity, and obedience. Needless to say, Luther had definitely passed the point of no return. He was excommunicated by Pope Leo X in 1520. Luther threw the papal bull that excommunicated him into the fire. I guess you could say he wasn't impressed. By 1525, Luther's ideas had spread. That is the year that the Anabaptists were formed in Zurich, Switzerland. This was a voluntary association of believers with no connection or allegiance to any state. They had four major beliefs. First, they rejected secular agreements. They refused to take civil oaths, pay taxes, hold public office, or even to serve in the military. Second, they opposed childhood baptism as only adults they felt could make the decision to commit to Christ. Third, as millenarians, they believed the end of the world was near. Fourth, they rejected the idea of the Trinity. It is worth noting that some historians see the Anabaptists as the, quote, "left wing," end quote, of the Protestant Reformation. In 1532, a radical group of revolutionary Anabaptists took control of the northwestern German city of Münster. Led by John Leyden, they instituted the practice of polygamy, and John definitely took part in that. He had 16 wives. I can't imagine what his honey-do list must have been like. Women, believe it or not, served as leaders in the movement. All books except the Bible were burned in the city, and they began killing some Lutherans and Catholics. I think that is where they went wrong, as this caused, in 1534, a combined army of Protestant and Catholic forces to descend on the city and execute the leaders of the movement. However, the movement still had a long-term impact. Mennonites, founded by Dutch leader Menno Simons, were descendants of the Anabaptists. They emphasized pacifism, perhaps in reaction to what had happened in Munster. Another group, this one the Quakers in England, shared similar beliefs. Thousands of Quakers came to America, where they founded and controlled Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware. Unitarians, who reject the Trinity, were also influenced by Anabaptists. Finally, before we move on, you might not be surprised to learn that Luther did not believe in the legitimacy of any other faith except mainstream Protestantism. So let's talk about Calvinism, which some see as the most significant of the new Protestant sects. Founded by John Calvin, a Frenchman who was influenced by humanism and Luther. I don't want to go too far into Calvinism, so let's just summarize it, the most important parts. Calvinism postulated the idea of predestination. Since God is all-knowing, he already knows who is going to heaven and who is destined for hell. Thus, the good works isn't sufficient for salvation, and there is no free will because God has already made his decision. However, good works are a sign that one has been chosen for salvation. God reveals if one has been chosen for salvation by a conversion experience. The church is made up of a group of people known as the elect. These people have had a conversion experience. Calvinists believe that they should be model Christians. In other words, they should be visible saints. Now, Calvinists were the most militant and uncompromising of all Protestant sects. They created what was referred to as the consistory, a judiciary made up of lay elders who had the power to impose harsh penalties for those who did not follow God's law. Activities such as drinking, singing of secular music, dancing, usury, and gambling were expressly prohibited. However, one thing that was not prohibited was work. Calvinists stressed the importance of hard work and accompanying financial success as a sign that God was pleased. Now, the spread of Calvinism had a far greater impact on future generations than Lutheranism. Presbyterianism, a form of Calvinism, was established in Scotland by John Knox. The Dutch Reformed Church developed in the United Provinces of the Netherlands. And then the Puritans in England, central, of course, to our story. They pressured Elizabeth I for more reforms, but they were kept largely at bay. They did go on to establish colonies in America and New England. Further, they were victorious in the English Civil War. This leads us to the English Reformation. We spoke earlier of one of the early English reformers, John Wycliffe. Remember, his followers still existed in the 16th century. William Tyndale, a humanist, translated the Bible into English in 1526, which became the basis for the King James Version of the Bible. So, England had reform-minded people laying the groundwork for the Reformation before the Reformation actually started. Now, the major person responsible for unleashing the Reformation in England, however, was not a churchman like in other areas. Instead, it was King Henry VIII. He was the second monarch from House Tudor and ruled from 1509 through 1547. He had, at one point, been a conservative Catholic who supported the church and the Pope and opposed the Protestant Reformation. He was such a staunch defender of the faith that the Pope awarded him the title Defender of the Faith. However, it should be noted that, since the 14th century, the English Catholic Church already had a significant degree of autonomy. Kings had the power to appoint bishops. I'm sure you've heard the story, but it never hurts to repeat it. Henry sought an annulment from his wife, Catherine of Aragon, because she could not bear a son. Only one daughter, Mary, had survived out of five childbirths. And having a son was needed to preserve the strength of the Tudor dynasty. Remember, the Tudors came to power at the end of the War of the Roses, so Henry was quite aware of what the lack of an heir could do to the kingdom. To make matters worse, his daughter Mary was betrothed to the heir of the French throne. Thus, if she inherited the throne from her father, England would be subject to French control. Henry, or so the story goes, thought all of this was punishment for the fact that he had married his brother's widow. However, he had earlier on received a papal dispensation allowing him to marry Catherine, but now he wanted an annulment. There was also, if you remember, the fact that he had a mistress with whom he was enamored, Anne Boleyn. Pope Clement VII was unable to grant Henry his wish. This was because the army of Charles V, the Holy Roman Emperor, had just sacked Rome. Catherine of Aragon was Charles's aunt. An annulment would make her an adulteress. The situation continued to simmer until 1533, when Cardinal Thomas Cranmer convinced the king that he could divorce Catherine and break away the church from Rome. The first act Henry took was to get the Act of Supremacy of 1534 passed. This made the king officially the head of the church in England. This then led to the confiscation of Catholic lands, or about 25% of all lands in England. Royal revenues doubled almost overnight. This money led to a military buildup. Nobles, especially in the south, purchased large tracts of land as a result of this. The next step was the passing of the Act of Succession. All of the king's subjects had to take an oath of loyalty to the king as the head of the Anglican Church. Henry famously ordered the execution of Thomas More for refusing to take this oath. However, the reality is, Henry changed very little. The Anglican Church maintained most of the Catholic doctrines. For example, the seven sacraments, clerical celibacy, and even transubstantiation, although it was now independent from Rome. This leads us to Elizabeth I. And yes, I know, I'm skipping Edward VI and Mary Tudor, but this isn't an English history podcast, so I'm just trying to give you the highlights. Elizabeth, because she was the daughter of Henry and Anne Boleyn, was seen as illegitimate by Catholics. Perhaps this is why she, to some extent, held strongly Protestant views. In the end, Elizabeth effectively oversaw the development of Protestantism in England. Elizabeth was a masterful politician, able to navigate the middle ground between Anglicanism and Protestantism and the Puritans, who wanted to reform the church in a more radical way than even Elizabeth was willing to do. Elizabeth and her advisors came up with what is referred to as the Elizabethan settlement. England required conformity to the Church of England, but people were, in effect, allowed to worship Protestantism and Catholicism privately. For its part, the Anglican Church resembled the Lutheran Church. Some church practices, including ritual, resembled Catholic practices. Furthermore, the Book of Common Prayer was instituted in 1559. All in all, there were seven major changes. We've already mentioned two, so let's continue. The third was that while Catholicism remained, especially among the gentry, it could not be practiced openly. Church services were given in English. Monasteries were not reestablished. The clergy was allowed to marry, and finally everyone was required to attend Anglican church services, and you could be fined if you were absent. You can probably imagine many of the gentry who benefited when they were able to increase their landholdings were not happy with this turn of events. This is going to lead to the English Civil War, but that's out of our domain, so I'm not going to talk much about it. To wrap up all of this, let's talk about the results of the Reformation. First, the unity of Western Christianity was shattered. Northern Europe, Scandinavia, England, and part of Germany and France, Switzerland, and Scotland adopted Protestantism. Second, religious enthusiasm was rekindled. Abuses in the Roman Catholic Church were remedied, believe it or not. And finally, sadly, religious wars broke out in Europe for well over a century. But most important to our story, the Puritans who wanted to purify the Church of England were not satisfied with things as they stood in the early years of the 17th century. Okay, well, that's it for today. Next time, we'll talk about Plymouth and the Massachusetts Bay Colonies. Until next time, have a great day. Do you like the sound of the American History Podcast? My audio production is provided by the Mad Octopus. Check them out over at madoctopusmedia.com.